It's at the end of the green line.
Okay, maybe on the green line, but it's like a 15-minute drive from Boston.
Maybe I live on the V line, and I've never been that far down.
The
green line kind of
sucks.
Hey, there's
nothing.
The green line? Yeah,
thanks. Except that all the trains are old, and
unless you're into some of them, but yeah. I live right outside Kenmore.
Unless you're
Kenmore, that's
right. We can look around the C line. All the other trains kind of suck. It's cool sometimes when they get like painted over with these ridiculous liquor ads. Maybe they'll just paint an entire car red or something.
They replaced a lot of the B trains in the last year.
The B line still sucks.
So today what's going to happen is that, first of all, I'll very quickly review what was going on last time, and then we'll finish the proof that ideals have inverses in the group of fractional ideals. That's to say, we'll prove that the group of fractional ideals is a group. And we were almost done with that yesterday, but there were a few things to finish. And after doing that, we will prove that every ideal factors uniquely as a product of prime ideals. So that's sort of one of the most important basic things in the course. So we'll do that, and then after doing that, we'll start with chapter 4, which is on how to use magma and Perry to do algebraic number theory computations along the lines of what we've done so far. So I'll tell you, when I do this, I'm not going to talk about some of the big problems such as computing class scripts yet. All I'm going to do is talk about computing with objects that I've already told you about in the course. Okay, any questions or comments? Also, you should hand in your homework today to Andre, who isn't here yet. But how about if we just make this stack paper and give it to Andre? So hand your homework down this way and make sure it ends up in this stack.
And then this currently has yours.
What?
Can we just email it to Andre?
You'll have to ask Andre when he gets here. And I'm sure he'll say yes, but I don't know for sure. Sure. You might prefer to have a printout as an example. Okay, so let's get going. One of the things we proved last time was that any ideal divides a product of prime ideals. That is to say, it contains a product of some prime ideals. So we proved that. And then we got most of the way towards proving that if you have an ideal I, a fractional OK ideal I, then it has an inverse. Or the inverse of I is, just as I said, it's the set of A. If I is an integral ideal, actually, no, just in general, I have fractional ideal. Define I inverse to be the set of A in K such that A I is contained in OK. And then the thing we want to prove is that this product, which by construction is contained in OK, is actually equal to OK. That makes I inverse the inverse of I in the group of fractional ideals for K. Yes?
Is it true that can we represent any fractional ideal as alpha times beta inverse or alpha and beta are integer values?
Well, first you can represent any fractional ideal as alpha times an integral ideal. Because you just take, you can just find some, if you have an arbitrary fractional ideal, you can find some, say, beta, so that beta times I is contained in OK by clearing denominators. Take a basis for I and clear denominators, and take beta to be something sort of a product of all the denominators of a basis. So this is an integral ideal, because it's an ideal, so is equal to some integral ideal J. So I is then J beta inverse. And here the beta is also in OK. And so you have that this arbitrary fractional ideal is an integral ideal times the inverse of an integral ideal. So the answer to your question is yes. Okay. And also, as I pointed out before, you only have to prove this whole inverses business for integral ideals, because you can always multiply an integral ideal by an element of K, actually an element of OK. Sorry, you can multiply any fractional ideal by an element of OK to get an integral ideal. So it suffices to prove the existence of inverses for integral ideals, since it's easy to see that principal fractional ideals have an inverse, the inverse being the principal fractional ideal generated by the inverse of the generator. Okay, so let's get on with the proof. What we did last time was prove this for prime ideals. So last time we showed that if you have a prime ideal, then P inverse times P, well, there were two possibilities. Either, well, we had sort of the situation where it contains P, because after all, P inverse contains all of OK, just from the definition. So you have a containment like this, and it's contained inside of OK, because P inverse, it's constructed to be a bunch of things that when you multiply, you always end up in OK. So you have this, and there are two possibilities that you had, because P is a prime ideal, either you have equality here or equality there. If you have equality on the right, we're done, because that's what we want to show. So we assumed we had equality here, and under that hypothesis, via some kind of technical sequence of steps, you have that, so if P is equal to P inverse P, so in the proof, by the way, I didn't denote it by P inverse yet, because we didn't know that it was really the inverse of P, but I'll just write it that way for now. If P equals P inverse P, then we found a D in P inverse, but D is not in OK. That is to say, if you have equality here, then there's something that multiplies P into OK, but it's not in OK itself, or something outside of OK. So a reason you might expect something like this to exist is, for example, imagine P is the ideal generated by a usual prime number, like 7 in the integers. Then 1/7 is an element of this, because 1/7 multiplies that ideal into the integers. So it's reasonable to expect that you'd have something like this, and we prove that, in fact, you do. Now, the thing that I mentioned at the very end, too quickly, just in words, is that you get a contradiction from this. This D has the property that it preserves P. Notice that D times P, well, because you have equality here, D times P, whatever it is, has to be contained in P. Now, here's why that's a contradiction. It's a contradiction. So right here we're using this because of this. It's a contradiction because you could do the following. Choose a basis for P as a Z module. So I'm going to state this very precisely because it's a trick we use a lot. So choose a basis. We're just considering as an abelian group now. A basis, let's say, omega 1 through omega n for P as a Z module. That is an abelian group. Now, take D. It acts on P. So D times omega 1 is a linear combination of omega 1 through omega n. D times omega 2 is a linear combination of omega 1 through omega n. There's a matrix that represents the action of left multiplication by D on the span of these omega I. So you have left multiplication by D. It's given by, there's a matrix for it with respect to this basis. I call the basis B. And that basis, just some big matrix with integer entries. And its characteristic polynomial is hence a monic polynomial with integer entries. But D satisfies its characteristic polynomial. First, by the Cayley-Hamilton theorem, a matrix satisfies its characteristic polynomial. And if you plug in, so that means that if you take left multiplication by D and substitute it into this polynomial, you get something that acts as zero. So left multiplication by D substituted into this polynomial, so if we call this polynomial f of x, left multiplication by f of D acts as zero on here. And that means it must be the zero element. Nothing acts as zero on P except the zero element. Because you can't have a non-zero thing. So notice that, how to argue that. Well, first the analogy with the usual integers, if you have an ideal generated by a prime, nothing multiplies as zero. I mean, it's just the fact that it's an integral domain, right? If you had something that acted as zero on P, and because P is non-zero, you'd have something non-zero times a non-zero thing being zero. So because OK is an integral domain, or because K, a field, is an integral domain, when you plug in D to F and get something that acts as zero on here, you see that D must itself be, I mean, F of D must be zero. So F satisfies this monic polynomial of integer entries. Therefore, D is an algebraic integer. So the fact that you have this implies that D is an algebraic integer. Because it satisfies a monic polynomial of integer entries. Because D leaves a lattice, if you like. You can call this a lattice invariant. Anytime you have a number that leaves a lattice invariant when you're multiplying on it, that number must be an algebraic integer. I mean, think about it. If you tried to, you had some finitely generated Z module and you tried to make something like 1/2 act on it, you'd fail because you'd constantly, when you multiply, you'd introduce bigger and bigger denominators of 2. So things that aren't algebraic integers, they don't leave lattices invariant, and conversely. So we see that D is an algebraic integer. That means it's an OK, which is a contradiction because D was assumed to not be an OK. The D we constructed was not an OK. So that's a problem. So there can't be, you can't be in this case where P is P inverse P. So you have to be in the case where P is not P inverse P, which means because P is a maximal ideal, that P inverse P is OK. And that establishes that this set is in fact the fractional ideal inverse of the prime ideal P. So we have inverses now, which is nice. Okay, now let's extend this to arbitrary ideals, arbitrary non-zero integral ideals. So we have to now show that every non-zero integral ideal has an inverse. So here's how you do it. So now show any non-zero I containing OK has an inverse. Okay, so now let's consider the set S of all I that don't have an inverse. And because OK is Noetherian, this set has a maximal element. So let's call that element I, maximal element I. So now we have an ideal. It has no inverse, but any bigger ideal does have an inverse. Any ideal that strictly contains it will have an inverse by assumption. And now, remember, it's a general fact that follows from Zorn's lemma, it follows from Zorn's lemma that which is equivalent to the axiom of choice, but it's an axiom that every ideal in a commutative ring is contained in a maximal ideal. So this I is contained in some, remember prime and maximal are the same thing for non-zero ideals. It's contained in some P. And the nice thing is that this is maximal or prime. The nice thing is that we've proved that primes have an inverse. So we know that this P has an inverse. So just take both sides of this equality, this inclusion, and multiply by P inverse. And here's what you get. I'll do it over here. So we have P inverse times I is contained in P inverse times P, which we proved is okay. And I is contained in P inverse because, so this one is because P inverse contains okay. And the reason for that is just from the definition. Notice that certainly every element of okay satisfies this condition, since your I is an ideal. Okay, so we have this, 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 this. Okay, so this is okay. This is our ideal. Now we have this ideal between them. What we'd like is that this ideal, P inverse I, is bigger than I, because then it would not be in the set S, and it's it would have an inverse. And then we could take the inverse of that and use it to construct an inverse for I. So that's what we want. But it's, of course, possible a priori, before we prove something, that you have equality here. So let's assume that for the moment and then deduce a contradiction. So if I is equal to P inverse I, then we want a contradiction. Okay, so how do we figure that? Okay, so there has to be something in P inverse that's not in OK. Because if P inverse were contained in OK, when you multiply P inverse by P, you just get P back. You wouldn't get OK. So there is an alpha that's in P inverse, but alpha is not in OK. All I'm saying is that P inverse is not contained in OK. It's got to have something that has a denominator in it. You just think about taking the inverse of a prime, you get 1 over P. So, but the precise argument is that if P inverse is contained in OK, then P inverse times P is contained in P. But actually, P inverse P is equal to OK. So it's not. So we do have this. And now we just use what I explained over here. Yet again, you take this alpha, and notice that it preserves I. And I is a Z-module of finite rank. So we have alpha times I is contained in I. So again, you imagine taking a basis for I and writing down a matrix for alpha with respect to that basis that'll have integer entries. Take the characteristic polynomial. It's a polynomial with integer entries. It's monic, and alpha satisfies it. Therefore, alpha must be an algebraic integer, which implies that alpha is an OK, which is a contradiction because we've taken alpha to not be an OK. So we're not in this case. We're in the case when you don't have equality here. So we know that we don't have equality there. OK, so contradiction. And then hence, I is strictly contained in P inverse I. Now we take this P inverse I, it's not an S. So by maximality, P inverse I is not an S. So it has an inverse, say J. So it has an inverse. So P inverse I has an inverse J. And now if you take P inverse J, that'll be an inverse for I. So we have that P inverse I times J, this is OK. So now if you take I times P inverse J, and use associativity of ideal multiplication, this is also OK. So that means that P inverse J is an inverse for I. So now we've shown that any integral ideal has an inverse. That is to say, well, so this set is not empty. I mean, no, this set is empty. So that completes the proof that the set of fractional ideals forms a group. The first thing was to show that if you have a prime ideal, an integral prime ideal, that it has an inverse, and we just wrote it down. The second step was to show if you have an integral ideal, then it has an inverse, and you got that by considering the set of ideals that don't have an inverse, taking a maximal element, which exists because OK is Noetherian, and then noticing that your maximal element has to be contained in a maximal ideal by Zorn's lemma. And once you have that, then you just consider the one possibility that would cause you trouble. You find that it doesn't happen. I'm putting the homework over there for you. You find that it doesn't happen because of this contradiction. And hence, you don't have equality here. Hence, this thing does have an inverse. Hence, I has an inverse, as we saw over there. Once I times P inverse has an inverse, you get an inverse for I. So now we know that each thing has an inverse. So if you take the set of all fractional ideals, that's a group, because you have a composition, you have associativity, closure, whatever, and you have the existence of inverses. And so inverses are unique. Yes?
Does the inverse of an arbitrary ideal have the same form as the one you wrote down for prime ideals?
That question occurred to me, and I had suggested that by what I wrote at the beginning. It occurred to me as I was writing this, and I realized that I don't know for sure what the answer is. The proof definitely doesn't give that. Let's think about it for a second. The thing I wrote down would definitely... whatever the inverse is, it has to be contained in the thing I wrote down, right? Because the inverse has the property that when you multiply, you get OK. So you have one inclusion, at least. On the other hand, the thing I wrote down, I think from that you can get that it has to be... Let's just try it now. So, okay, the question is the following. I've proven that every fractional ideal has an inverse. And actually, there's a unique inverse because we now have a group structure, and inverses are unique in a group. His question was the following. What's your name?
Steve.
Steve's question was, I've proven via this funny multiplication, this is how I ended up constructing the inverse, it's P inverse times I. So I really only used explicitly the formula I gave for inverses for prime ideals. And his question is, if I take an arbitrary, say, integral ideal, fractional ideal, but let's start with integral ideal of I, is the inverse of I, question, is I inverse equal to the set of all alpha in K, such that alpha times I is contained in OK? Since I only showed that the inverse is of this form for prime ideals, I did not show this for arbitrary ideals. I just showed that arbitrary ideals have inverses. Okay, is the question clear to everyone? Any comments about the question, such as an answer?
Well, if you already know, if you knew a priori like prime decomposition,
yes,
can't you just say that the ideal generated by the primes that we did not cover are in I? Will keep it in OK, so that will give you the inverse?
Maybe. I don't completely follow what you said, but it might very well be right.
So
we're about to prove prime decomposition. We haven't quite done that yet, but we'll do that in just a minute. Yes?
So you got the inclusion?
Yes, let me write down which inclusion I have. So I'll call this J to avoid confusion. Is J equal to this the inverse of I? Now the question will be clear. The inverse of I. Okay, now we have an inclusion, which is that the inverse of I, whatever it is, we know there's a unique inverse of I, and it has the property that I times I inverse is contained in OK. So every element of I inverse has to be in J, because J is the set of all elements that multiply I into OK. So just from the property that the inverse satisfies, I inverse is contained in J. Okay? Now what?
I suppose you had other elements, like outside of alpha inverse.
Okay, suppose, let me write this down. So suppose, I'll call it beta. Suppose beta is in J, but beta is not in I inverse. Okay?
Then beta times beta times I equals beta times I. Okay, which is alpha I inverse times I.
Alpha I inverse times
I.
I think it's just I inverse times I. Like that?
I'm going to use like division.
That's okay. We have division. We're in a group.
So that means their ratio is integer.
Beta's in. You're just canceling the I's from both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that. So that means that beta is in I inverse.
So you did it.
Yeah. Great. Was this what you, Karina, you had a comment?
Yeah.
That's this. Okay, good. Excellent. So the answer to Steve's question is yes. The inverse really is just the thing given by that formula. Okay, yes.
Is there any proof of this that does not make use of source level?
I don't know how to do it at first.
It should be done.
A huge amount of commutative algebra depends on storm someone. But, yes?
Can you talk a bit about why we can't cancel ideals right there?
Yeah, so what you have is, let's just prove a general cancellation lemma. But the intuition first is that what this says is that it says that I inverse I divides beta I. And that means there's some multiple of this that's equal to that. And then you can cancel. But that's not really a good explanation. Okay, so let's see. What can we do? So suppose you have I times J contained in I times M, where I, J, and M are ideals. And the conclusion we'd like to make is that J is contained in M, right? Okay, so we've proven that there's an ideal I inverse with the property that when you multiply I times I inverse, you get OK. So we know that exists. So let's multiply I times J by I inverse. And let's also multiply I times M by I inverse. And I claim that you still have an inclusion. And I think that's pretty reasonable. I mean, anytime you have an inclusion, you can multiply both sides and you still get an inclusion. And I use associativity to cancel. Here, simplify. And you end up with J contained in M. I think that's exactly what we used here. We just multiply both sides by I inverse, and then you have beta contained in I inverse. Okay, so I've just applied this cancellation up here. So more precisely, you have the ideal generated by beta times I contained in I inverse times I. So now you can cancel the I's, and you get the ideal generated by beta is contained in I inverse.
Or
okay.
Simply, you could have just multiplied by I inverse both sides.
That's right, but that's how you prove that you can do cancellation.
And briefly, why is OK times an ideal the ideal?
So OK is supposed to be the identity element. I guess we skipped proving that it's the identity element in the group of fractional ideals, but it is. Let's see if we can verify that. So claim OK times I is equal to I for any fractional ideal. So it suffices. Well, let's just think about integral ideals, and once you have that, you can do general case. So why is this? Well, first, you certainly have.
One inclusion follows.
Yeah, one.
Yeah. So OK times I is certainly contained in I. This is from the fact that I is an ideal.
Yeah.
And so it's invariant. And the other inclusion is the one that follows, which uses that one's in there. So. So what is the other inclusion? That I is contained in here, and that's because one's in there. Yes. Yeah. So this is because it's an ideal, and this is because one is in OK. Okay, any more things we've missed from our foundations? Okay, so now all we have to do to really get the theorem is the one thing that remains is unique factorization. So it's really nice, we've now produced a group. The group structure isn't that interesting. Maybe I'll just make a quick aside about this. It's as you'll find in the homework, one of the problems in the homework is to show that if you have two number fields and you take the group of fractional ideals, you get exactly the same group as an abstract abelian group. It just doesn't depend at all on the number field as an abstract abelian group. So this association that goes from a number field to you have the ring of integers, and then you have the group of fractional ideals. You're like, wow, exciting, there's a group I didn't know about before. But at least as an abstract abelian group, it's really not that exciting. It's just, in general, it's isomorphic, as you'll show in your homework. I mean, well, one way you could do your homework is to show that it's the same as the positive rational numbers under multiplication, that group. So it's kind of boring in a sense. You have this group, it's nice that it has a group structure, but just as an abstract group, it's not an amazingly interesting construction. But as I mentioned before, if you take this group and quotient out by the principal fractional ideals, then you get an extraordinarily interesting group, which is the class group of the number field. It's a group that we'll prove is finite. It's not obvious at all that it is finite, but we'll prove that. And its structure is extremely crucial to understanding algebraic number theory type things. Okay, so let's prove that you have unique factorization. And this theorem, the fact that ideals factor uniquely, is the reason that ideals were invented initially, ever. I mean, ideals go back to work on Fermat's last theorem, and by Dedekind and others, and he introduced ideals to deal with the fact that you do not, in general, have unique factorization in number fields. Somebody had thought they proved Fermat's last theorem, I think Lemay, under the hypothesis that, well, he just implicitly assumed that you have unique factorization in cyclotomic extensions of Q, and you don't. And this is pointed out, but instead of working with numbers, you work with ideals, and then you can get somewhere, because ideals do factor uniquely. So the whole theory of ideals started right here at this theorem. Okay, so here's the theorem. If I is an ideal in OK, then I factors as a product of primes uniquely up to ordering. So after reordering the PIs, there's exactly one factorization like this. And there is a factorization like this. Okay, now for the proof, which is it's yet again an application of the fact that OK is a Noetherian ring. First, we take all ideals that don't factor as a product of primes, and amongst that set, it's a set of elements, or a set of ideals in OK. If it's non-empty, it has a maximal element. So that's the first step. Let S be a set of ideals in OK. Always assume non-zero. And these are ones that do not factor as a product of primes. And it would be nice if this set were empty, and we're done. But if it's not empty, it contains a maximal element, because OK is Noetherian. And let's let I be such a maximal element. So I is an ideal, and by hypothesis, it does not factor as a product of prime ideals. It's certainly not a prime ideal itself, because otherwise it would factor as a product of prime ideals. So it's contained in a non-zero prime ideal. And I mean, I'm erasing stuff that I'm going to write again, because the argument does have a similar flavor to what we just did. So we have our ideal I, and it's contained, as any ideal is, in a prime ideal. And prime ideal is contained in OK. So, and we know that we do not have equality here, because if we did, I would be prime, and then you'd have a factorization. So the trick is to consider I times P inverse, yet again. It's something that's bigger than I. We'll prove it's bigger than I. Once we have that, then we'll be done, because I times P inverse will have a factorization. Anything bigger than I is not an S. I times P inverse will have a factorization, then you multiply both sides by P, and you get that I has a factorization. So you can already see what's going on. So you have I, I contained in I times P. P inverse, and that's contained in, now I'm multiplying both sides of this by, I'm multiplying both sides of this by P inverse, so that's contained in P times P inverse, which is equal to OK. So, so we're done if you have the, that's a strict inclusion, so we have to worry about the possibility that it's not a strict inclusion. So if I is equal to I P inverse, well, it's exactly what I erased from the board, foolishly. If you had this equality, then as I mentioned only moments earlier, well, there's something in P inverse that's not in OK, because P is a, I mean, again, if P inverse were contained in OK, then P times C inverse would be contained in P, and it wouldn't be equal to OK. So you have something in P inverse not in OK, but it leaves this lattice invariant. Therefore, it has to be integral contradiction. So you can't have that. If this contradiction as several times, as twice before. So you have a strict inclusion. I is strictly contained in I times P inverse, and that means by maximality of I that this I times P inverse is a product of primes P, say P2 through PR. And this is by maximality of him. Okay, but now you just multiply both sides by P, and you have that I is equal to P times P2 dot dot PR. So we just did it. We've now shown that every ideal is a product of primes. That's it. Except we have to show uniqueness. Yes?
Do we want I not to be equal to OK?
That would be the empty product. So I is not equal to OK because it would factor as a product of primes. Namely, it would be the empty product. OK. So it's a convention. I equals OK is the empty product. OK, any other comments or questions? So what remains is to show uniqueness. And then we'll be done. So here, assume that you have a product of primes P1 through PR equal to another product of primes Q1 through QS. Okay, and now we just need to show that you can cancel, but any like Q1 appears here, you have to show that P1 appears over here. Then you can cancel them, and then you repeat this inductively, and you find that the primes appearing on both sides are the same. Okay, so our goal is to show that P1 is amongst the Q1 through QS. So goal, and we've actually shown basically this before, the goal show that some Q sub I is P1. And what you have here is that, let's see, so P1 divides, that is, contains Q1 through QS, right? P1 divides P1, the product P1 through PR, hence P1 divides Q1 through QS, and divides as contains. So I'm just rewriting I'm just using the fact that P1 divides this product. P1 divides that product, as P1 divides the other product, which means that P1 contains this product. Now, what you do is, so the nice thing about these ideals, they're all prime ideals, so either you have, I mean, if ever you have an inclusion, then you have equality. So if no QI is contained in P1, then for each I, you can find some AI, so the AI is in QI, but not in P1. So if P1 does not contain QI for each I, then find an AI that's in QI, but AI is not in P1. That's just from the definition of not contains. Okay? Now what you do is you take the product of the AIs. That's got to be in this product. So A1 times dot F times AS, that's in this product. Hence, it's in P1. But P1 is a prime ideal. And if you have a product of things in a prime ideal, one of those things must be in the prime ideal. But that's a contradiction to how we chose the AI. So, but A1 through AS is in P1. So, some AI is in P1. A contradiction. Therefore, you must have an inclusion for some I. There must be some I so that P1 is contained in, I mean, it does contain QI. But if you have an inclusion of non-zero prime ideals, because we're in a Dedekind domain, every prime ideal is maximal, those two things have to be equal. So P1 equals QI for some I. Okay, so you have P1 is the same as one of these, you cancel them, and then you continue. And you see that the factorizations are the same. Because after you've canceled everything from the left-hand side, you have OK is some product, but then, that product's not going to be equal to OK. You can have a product of prime ideals equal to OK. You can't. So let me think about that for a second. So what if you canceled everything and you have OK equal to Q1 through Qn? Why is that a problem?
Yes, because you know that every inverse of some integral domain contains some non-integral.
Yeah, that's a very good argument. Because so Q2 through Qn would be an inverse for Q1. That product is integral, but we already know that anytime you take the inverse of a prime, it contains something not in OK. It's not integral. So that's a perfect argument to show that this isn't possible.
Same thing as it's trying to make one.
Yeah. Okay, so we've done it. We've now proved that in the ring of integers of a number field, you have unique factorization of ideals into prime ideals. Okay, so that's really good. We've gone through a complete proof of that. It also works for fractional ideals. The only difference is that instead of writing a fractional ideal as a product of primes, non-negative integer exponents, you get a product of primes where you can have a so any fractional ideal is Q1 through PR times Q1 inverse dot 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 QS inverse. So you can have possibly negative powers of primes. That's the only difference. It's just like with rational numbers. You can factor any rational number uniquely as a product of primes where you allow negative exponents. So exactly the same is true here. And you can see this just by taking your fractional ideal, multiplying it by some element of OK to get an integral ideal, factoring that, and then factoring the element of OK, and then you just divide through again. So every fractional ideal also factors uniquely. So in the sense that the number of, you're right. You need to cancel from the top and bottom. That's a very good point. So you have unique factorization of fractional ideals, assuming you put them in lowest terms. So you don't have, say, PR equal to Q1, and they could cancel. So, good point. Okay, so now the next part of the course is to tell you about two computer algebra systems, Magma and Parry. And in order to do that, I need to set up my computer so I can show them on the projection screen. So we'll have a few minute break while I do that, okay? So we'll start at 11, and I'll do that for a half hour. I have way more to tell you about the systems than I can do in a half hour, so I'll continue with that on Thursday as well.
No, I can't. I have a
has to.
Or
is it the other direction?
She keeps like making a point of noting that I don't want the.
You have an extra copy? Or?
It's like, so this is how we do things at 965. Do you follow everything,
Steve? I have my copy. I made 14 copies. There are 12 people. There should be.
He didn't remember the term chart in some sense to describe the coordinate system sort of on a manifold.
Very well. I got quite used to that while I was in 755.
What's that?
I got quite used to that while I was in 755.
And then I dropped it.
Yeah.
Well, and a person said something silly about the point. It was like,
so you don't have a copy of
the manifold.
Right
like,
can you sit next to somebody?
That every once in a while we're going to apply the forgetfulness.
And I'll hand you my copy once we're done today.
And then
can
you, and
can I have a quick photograph?
And then he said, well, like, trying to drop. Yeah. And then we can like search all sorts of nice
deep bullshit.
And Steve, I know you didn't have it, but I'll explain things as we go along.
Neurobiology. I was deciding between two cores.
It's where you forget the complex manifolds or complex manifolds and assume that they're not manifolds instead. According to my professor. No.
That would
be pretty cool. Yeah. That's exact.
Yeah. See, I didn't need to take real analysis. Really took complex analysis first, and then I applied complex
functions. I assume it's also contravariant because we have to go back and check one of the
complex analytic functions are much nicer than real analytic functions. So
yes.
Watch out.
Well,
like analytic continuation's unique.
Right.
You don't have that for real
right. Well,
analytic
like,
continuation.
Well, likewise, I'm taking a course in several complex variables, and we're learning that like complex manifolds in general are nicer.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't like manifolds.
Sorry.
Turn on.
Well, it's quite tricky. I did a seminar.
That's a little disturbing.
So I didn't have to take measure and integration this term because it's supposed to be done at very same class.
Nobody was going to make you take it.
I was going to
make
you take it. Had the hour free, and now I don't.
Okay. Does anyone want to try to turn this thing on while I lower the screen? Maybe it's switching up.
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah. Should have these screen. Yeah, I'll sustain. It finally showed up on the greater part, so I have any interest in
three. Yeah, you showed me yesterday.
Yeah. It should have a greater degree at the time. Oh yeah, because I haven't taken 6003. Well, I'll catch it soon.
Whenever I'm going to take some other class that's actually interesting.
I didn't say I was going to take 003. That has yet to be seen.
You might not kind of surprise me.
What?
Not you.
Not disk space on the she's trying to do it for her on the partition. But well, the CD on the partition.
Yeah, actually
the
thing about Window Maker is being able to all the shortcuts is like I have to wait all the
You could do that in KDE. Yeah, that's really good shortcut stuff. No.
No, I ended up using some weird hack going against mod map. So I said like, you know, like F6 produces a Y with a diuresis, and then like I have window maker map that to some program.
Yeah.
It's kind of a hack, though. I don't. No, then you use a multi key to come up. Actually, no, it's still it's.
Like that.
I forgot she wants volume buttons on her keyboard, so I can do this. But like mostly kids for stuff. Like, if I need to train room, remember that like F7 is most of all.
Long and they're like,
yeah, no,
I like
that. Then you put little labels on your keyboard. I don't need to remember all that. So. And don't you use F7? Like, no, what do you use F7? Control off F7. But these only work when you're in X.
Sure?
Because
yes, I understand. Are you sure the keyboard can stay there while it switches?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so I think I'm ready to start. So what I'm going to do is tell you about the two main systems for doing algebraic number theory computations, but I'm only going to assume the algebraic number theory I'll assume you know is exactly what I've taught you so far. So there's tons and tons of stuff beyond what I've done so far that you'll learn about later, but these are two systems. First, I'm going to talk about Magma, and then I'm going to talk about Perry. I'll say a little bit about the systems overall now, and I'm just going to barely get into talking about Magma, and then we'll be done, and then on Tuesday I'll talk in much more. I'll finish up, hopefully, what I have here. Like, there's 12 pages here, so I don't know how much I'll get through, even on Tuesday. But it's useful to know about these two systems and know about the trade-offs in using one versus the other, etc. First, let me, so a little bit of background. There are several big problems in computing in algebraic number theory. One is to compute the ring of integers of a number field. Given k, find ok explicitly by giving a list of elements of k that generate ok as a Z module. So that's a hard problem in general. It's actually quite difficult. And it turns out that there are algorithms that get you pretty far, but really one of the hardest parts is factoring an integer. If you could factor integers quickly, you could find rings of integers much more quickly than we currently do. So there, surprisingly enough, that problem, which you might think is only a difficult problem relevant for cryptography, is also critically relevant to almost any algebraic number theory computations. So another problem is given an integer, prime number, a prime integer p, consider the ideal p times ok. Then you want to write that as a product of prime ideals. That's actually not so hard to do, but it's a useful one. And that's the, I think I'll talk about an algorithm for doing that on Thursday. That's due to Lenstra. Another thing is to compute the class group explicitly. So here you have the group of fractional ideals. If you quotient out by the principal fractional ideals, you get a finite group. Compute what it is. That's a very, very important question. Many, many, many computations that you will do that involve algebraic numbers, one of the basic things you must do in order to really get anywhere is to compute the class group. Another thing is to compute the units of the ring of integers. So uk equals the units of ok, a subgroup of invertible elements. Computing that is quite interesting as well. And it's if you've heard of Pell's equation, which you probably all have, that is the problem of computing the units in a real quadratic field. And one shocking thing about it is that to actually write down the units, for example, can be very difficult. The simplest unit can be huge compared to the discriminant of the field. Okay, so now a little bit of background. There are these two programs, Magma and Perry, which I think are by far the most popular for algebraic number theory type computations. Magma is actually a lot more of a general system than just algebraic number theory. That's something it does well, but it does many other things, such as does a lot of group theory and so on. I'm going to show you a couple of web pages. One is
If you go to my homepage, there's my homepage. There's my favorite number. Anyways, so there's something called the. It's kind of a. I'll answer that question during the elliptic curves part of the course. Ask me again later. it's really related to elliptic curves. Okay, so there's something called the Perry-Magma calculator, which I wrote. And what it does is it gives you a web interface to both Perry and Magma. So what you can do is you can enter any Perry or Magma code. So here's a very simple example, 2 plus 2. And if you click on the Perry button, it will send that to Perry, and Perry will evaluate it and then give you back the answer.
pretty sweet algorithm.
Well, yeah, there's some issue. It took a long time that time, but notice the second time I did it was much quicker. So I think it was loading something that's cached. So, and you see the answer is 4. And the actual computation time was only 0.007 seconds. So there's a lot of other time. So we could try something a little harder. Factor a random number. This should be pretty fast, but at least you see it does it. And you have most of Perry available to you via this web interface. And Magma also, which has different command names, but so in Magma, the command is factorization. You can click there, and it feeds it to Magma and then gives you the output. And
do you not need semicolons at the end?
This program will include the semicolons automatically for you. It just sticks one at the end. So if you are at any web browser anywhere in the world, you can use Magma or Perry via this web page, which is especially nice given that Magma isn't free. Perry is a completely free GPL program, open source, etc. Magma is not a free program at all. Fortunately, being in this course gives you access to Magma, which you can download and install on your computer. And I'll tell you how to do that. So the website is here. Let me let's see. I need to give you a password. Get Magma. Okay, so this is the web page, this is the login, this is the password. So write that down. If you do this, then you can download Magma for your computer. And I put versions for Windows, Mac, OS 10, and Linux up. They're slightly old, but I think they should be fine for the class. I tried to put new versions last night, but I wasn't able to get them. But so it's my webpage /getmagma. And then this. If, for example, you don't have a piece of paper, you can send me an email or something.
Okay,
okay. Send somebody else an email. So I've worked for Magma 3 times. I've gone down. Magma's developed at the University of Sydney in Australia. It's a non-profit, sort of grant-supported system. And I've visited them 3 times to work on the system. And I wrote their modular forms. The modular forms part of Magma. So they give it to me for free. And I asked about using it in the course, and they said, yeah, your students can use it. So you have completely legal access to Magma. So has everybody written this down? OK, so you can download it. Regarding Perry, Perry is a lot easier to get. You just type Perry into Google. And way down here, the 4th hit is the right hit. And then you just go to download, and you can download, like for Windows, it's really easy. You just click here, and there's a Windows installer that works well. And you can download a version and compile it yourself for any other platform. So getting Perry is not a problem at all. So there's the web page where you can use it without having to install anything except the web browser. And there's this place where you can download the Linux, Mac, or Windows versions. So like the Windows version is just this big setup program, which takes forever to run, I've been told. But anyways. And then you should read the instructions for the Mac version, since there's some tricky business in installing. All right, so let's see. All right, so now I'm going to give you kind of a demo of how to use Magma, at least start doing that. I'm using Magma under Emacs here, but you would typically just use it from the shell. And the reason I'm using it under Emacs is so that all the input and output that I type is logged, and so I can easily scroll back to previous things, which is better in a class environment. So you can, if I do something different than the notes, you can still, so I'm going to put the log up on the webpage so that you have access to it. Okay, so just a very basic thing in Magma is to compute the Smith normal form of a matrix. So I'm going to make a 2x2 matrix, A, there it is. Then I can say Smith normal form, and you get that I made a mistake. Smith form, whoops, there's no normal. So I change that, hide my mistake, and there you are, the Smith form. So what it actually does is outputs three matrices. It returns three separate things, which is very strange. It's a language where a function can output more than one answer. But it's not too confusing, it's just the way it is. So if you type the name of a function followed by semicolon, you get documentation for that function. So the Smith form command, the documentation is that it takes as input a matrix. Data types are really, really important in Magma. It takes its input a matrix, outputs a matrix, basically a square matrix and a square matrix. And then there are some options that have some effect on maybe how the computation works that you can ignore. So the stuff in brackets you can ignore. So what it does is it gives you the Smith form first, and then it gives you two matrices, P and Q, that transform your original matrix into Smith form. Okay? That's nice. And just flip to the next page. So the thing we'll try now is some kind of pushing of the limits and see how big of a Smith form you can compute for, say, a random matrix. So, yes? Yes, sorry.
So is there a command that'll tell me what all of the functions are within a certain field, like in Perry?
So in Perry, it's very easy to get a list of all commands. There aren't actually too many commands. In Magma, there's thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of commands available at any given moment, so it's pretty scary. Let's see. Not quite. Like, you can get all commands that start with N if you type N and hit the tab key. But really, the best way, let me just give you a quick tour of how to get to documentation about Magma. So if you type Magma into Google, then, Oops, not after that. So if you again go down a little ways, you'll find the computer. Oh, not again. Okay, Google didn't correct me. So it's the third one down. In here, there's Magma Online Help. And that's thousands and thousands of page reference manual that you can browse through. And the most relevant, so if for example, you can go to the index, which lists all commands. You can click on extensions of rings, which is the most relevant thing for number theory. And inside of that, there's a ton of stuff, like class field theory, cyclotomic fields, p-adic rings, Galois rings. This is just a tiny little piece of one section of the manual.
What's a lazy power series ring?
Don't know. Well, I mean, I do know. I think it's a ring where you define the elements via some formula, but you don't actually compute the coefficients of the power series to a high precision until you need them for a specific computation. Yeah. Yeah. So you could say add together two power series where you have a general rule for giving the nth coefficient, and then the sum would be a power series so that the rule for giving the nth coefficient is the sum of the other two rules. So you can do arithmetic without actually computing the things to large precision. Not that I've actually looked at this section, but I know that's what it should be based on the name. So there's a lot of stuff here. And if you click on orders and algebraic fields, then you get things that are relevant to these are the main things that are relevant for what we're doing. And you can just click next and page through it. So it tells you about number fields, where it comes from, et cetera, what the data types are, and then how to do some basic, how do you create a number field, et cetera, and then there's lots of example code. So this is really the documentation that you want to look at. And if you want to understand how Magma works kind of at a high level, what the basic language is and so on, you click on the Magma language. And it tells you what the, what is a function, what is a procedure, how do you read from the user, what is a statement, when do you have to use semicolons, that sort of thing. And if you want to see what I wrote, go to arithmetic geometry, and then I wrote the modular symbols, modular forms, and modular Boolean varieties parts of Magma. So for example, this part. Okay, so that's the documentation. And Perry also, as you pointed out, has documentation. There's documentation kind of internal, which is very nice in Perry, because Perry isn't so big, you can do that. And there's also a nice user's guide. Let's see. Oh, wow. It's all nice and... functions related to number fields, so just gives apparently a list of all the functions, or some of the functions. I don't know. I've never seen this documentation before. In any case, let me tell you more about the actual program magma. All right, so that's... So Smith normal form, you have this function, you can compute a Smith normal form. So let's try try to make things more interesting. So I'll say I'll make a line which computes a which creates a random matrix with entries between 0 and 100. And I'll explain this step by step. And then computes the Smith normal form and times how long it takes. Okay, so there's the line. And what it does is first it assigns 50 to the variable n. It looks very much like Pascal with colon equals. Next, you make a matrix. You give the number of rows of the matrix, the number of columns of the matrix, and the entries of the matrix. The entries, here what you do is you make the sequence where I iterates from 1 through n squared, and each time the entry is just a random number chosen between 0 and 100 by the random function. So what this is it's a sequence of, in this case, 50 squared, or 2,500 integers, each one between 0 and 100. And then it takes that, makes a matrix out of it by filling in the rows. So the first row is the first 100 things, the second row is the next 100 things in the sequence, and so on until it makes a matrix. That's a matrix of the integers, some big, a 50 by 50 matrix, and then it will compute the Smith form and output how much time it took to compute it. Okay? So on my laptop, it just took 0.03 seconds. So it's pretty good at doing a 50 by 50 Smith form. And then we can try a bigger one. I'm just going to try 100 by 100, and that takes 0.42 seconds. There's a similar thing in the notes at the bottom of page 35, but there I'm running on the fastest computer I have, which is a 64-bit dual Opteron machine. And on that one, it takes about half as much time for some of these. And we could just push the limits until it gets really slow. Like 150 by 150 on my laptop takes 2.5 seconds. And we could try 200 by 200. You know, it takes longer and longer. But doing this gives you some sense that magma can pretty efficiently compute, for example, Smith forms of matrices. So that's just something to illustrate the first day. Next, let's construct a number field, or define a number field in magma. So this is, in some sense, much more complicated than you might think it should be. In most computer algebra systems, something like x, indeterminate is just there, it's defined by default. In magma, nothing is defined by default. So for example, the rational numbers, you have to, if you want to make a polynomial over the rational numbers, first you have to call the rational number field, I mean the rational number function, to get the rational numbers. It's its own data type, and there it is. And then you say Rx is the polynomial ring over the rational field. So that means, what this line means is you define R to be the ring of polynomials in one variable over that thing, whatever that thing is. In this case, the rational numbers. You can put pretty much any ring imaginable here, though, which is kind of fun. For example, you can make a polynomial ring over a polynomial ring over a polynomial ring over a quotient of a polynomial ring. You can iterate this process indefinitely subject to the restraints of your computer. So, and this funny notation, diamond bracket x, that means that the indeterminate, the generator of the polynomial ring, is x. It should be printed out as x, and when you use x, that's what you mean. You mean the generator of the polynomial ring. So now I have this thing x. X is in the polynomial ring. I can write things like x cubed plus 1, which makes sense. I can do arithmetic with this. Etc., etc. So now, once I've defined that, I can define a number field. To define a number field, you give as input a polynomial over the rational numbers, and
again, what happens is that this number field has a generator, which is a root of this polynomial, and that's what's called A. It will be printed as A, and you can refer to it as A in input to other things.
So there's your A, and A is in the number field. Notice that X isn't in the number field because it's a polynomial. See, it's an error to even ask if X is in the number field. And also, A is not in the polynomial ring. That doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, so now the fun thing is now you can compute with A. You can do whatever algebra you want, and A is a cube root of 2. So for example, if you say A cubed, you get 2. If you say A squared, you don't get 2, of course. Or you could take some complicated expression like A squared plus A plus 10, and then raise it to the power of 100, and notice that the thing you get back is all the A cubes have been replaced by lower powers of A. So you get this big thing back, but this is just a polynomial and or it's just a linear combination of A squared, A, and 1. Also notice that it's fast. Magma is very, very fast at basic arithmetic with polynomials. Also over a finite field, it's incredibly fast at, say, multiplying two polynomials of huge degree. Has a lot of sophisticated algorithms for that. Okay, so now we have a number field. What can we do with it? There's some business about relative extensions. I'll skip that for now. So, because we haven't really thought about that much in class. So, rings of integers. Remember, OK, computing OK is a big deal. Computing with OK, that's sort of like the ring of integers is just sort of a very important basic thing. So, how do you get the ring of integers of a number field in magma? Well, amazingly enough, you use the command ring of integers. It's very sensible. Of K. And I'll call it... I don't really call it anything in the notes, but so I'll just print it out. So it doesn't really tell you anything. It just says it's the maximal equation order defined by that polynomial. So basically it's giving no information except I'm the ring of integers of this number field. It's not actually telling you anything about itself. So you can ask for a basis of the ring of integers. And again, you get no amazing information. A basis is, what does this notation mean, r.1? If you have anything in magma at all, anything, say R, then R.1 is the first generator of that thing, and R.2 is the second generator, and R.3 is the third generator, and R.4 is the fourth generator, and so on. Sorry. I'm kind of a sore throat. So you can, when we were looking at, for example, the polynomial ring before, and we used X to refer to the generator, you could have also written, R.1 to refer to the generator. Instead of X. The basis of your ring of integers is R.1, R.2, and R.3, which tells you absolutely nothing interesting at all. But here's what you can do. You can take each of these basis elements, so I'm letting B be the basis, and then you can coerce them into the number field K. And then you'll get them in terms of A. You'll get them as polynomials in terms of A. So what you do is you take, for example, the first, it indexes starting with 1 in magma. You take the first element of that list and you coerce it into K and you find out that it's really 1. If you take the second element and coerce it, you find out that it's really A, that is cube root of 2. And if you take the third element, the third basis vector, basis element, it's A squared. So basis for the ring of integers of Q adjoined cube root of 2 is 1, cube root of 2, and cube root of 2 squared. Just kind of nice. You could do the same thing with, let's now make the number field x squared minus 5. Remember, Q adjoined root 5, an algebraic integer in there is 1 plus root 5 over 2. So a basis for the ring of integers is not going to just be 1 in A in this case. So let's see what happens. Let R be the ring of integers of K. And again, you can say basis of R and you get nothing amazing. But you can say K bang, you can just say R.1 for the first generator and you get 1, and then the second one, something more interesting, it's 1 half A plus 1. It's 1 plus root 5 over 2, the golden ratio. By the way, you can ask for minimal polynomials of almost anything. And what I just did there with the $1 refers to the output of the previous command. So this means give me the minimal polynomial of the previous thing that I output, which is x squared minus x minus 1.
That's the middle polynomial of 1 plus root 5 over 2.
Okay, any comments or questions?
Exclamation mark.
Oh, it's an explanation point. In magma, explanation point means coercion. So so in magma you have explanation point in this is like in C where you say int, you know, something like that. This is like in, I don't know, maybe C++ where you might say where you use parentheses the other way. So, well, I mean, if you have a class in C++ like, I don't know, cal, then you say cal of 5, and that make that constructs a cal. So spherical. So it's just the this is coercion. Coerce into something. And it works for anything. Anytime you have something in magma, like a field, a polynomial ring, whatever, if you say that thing, explanation point, and then something that makes that can somehow be interpreted in that thing, then it gives you the resulting object in that thing. So another example, comments are like in C. Another example is we can make the polynomial ring again, Rx colon equals polynomial ring over the rational field, which I just called Q before. Then you could say R being 1, 2, 3, 4, and that will make the polynomial that kind of corresponds to that sequence. It coerces a sequence into the polynomial ring.
Oh, so
yes.
You coerce the thing on the other side.
Yeah, it's backwards to what you might think. Yeah. So it's kind of like in C, where you know the data type is on the left and the thing is on the right. But it's backwards from, well, no, it's similar to this too. It's just that it uses a bing for whatever reason, instead of parentheses. Let's see. So the last thing we'll do today, I think, is compute some rings of integers. So at the bottom of page 37, I've written a procedure which takes as input a polynomial over the rational numbers, and then it just prints out. What it does is it prints out a basis for the ring of integers. And what we'll do is just run it for various polynomials and see how long it takes. And interestingly, just to foreshadow next week, if you try exactly the same thing in Perry with the same examples, Perry is vastly faster than magma computing these rings of integers. However, interestingly, if you do Smith normal forms, magma is vastly faster than Perry. So these two systems, sometimes one's way better than the other in both directions. Though it should be more in the direction of magma being better because
that
Perry is open source.
Source.
Yeah, and magma isn't. But okay, so now I'm typing in a procedure. In magma, there are really three types of ways to define a function. One is a procedure. That's something that doesn't return anything. A function is the same as a procedure, but it must return something. And there's also something called an intrinsic, which you probably won't have to worry about for this. But an intrinsic is something like a procedure or a function, but it looks to the it somehow gets installed into this into the shell and looks like any other thing that is included with magma. So I won't go into more detail about that now. Okay, so we'll define this procedure, and what it does is it makes a number field. Then let's R be the maximal order. So this is the part that takes time, and then it prints out sequence of coercions of, so you can make these really nice list comprehensions here. So what happens here is that I've defined a procedure by just typing it in. So you can do you can put this in a file and then load the file with the command load quote file name. So semicolon. This is going to give an error because there shouldn't be anything named file, but I'm going to leave it there so it's in the log in case you when you look at this later. So what this procedure does is it first defines a number field, computes the maximal order, and then what it does is it makes the sequence of coercions of z into k, where z runs through a basis for the maximal order.
Okay, what do you mean by maximal order?
Maximal order is O sub k, the ring of integers. I'm sorry, maximal order and ring of integers are synonymous. They're this. So yeah, that's a little thing that I didn't write that. I didn't go over it. In the notes, I talked about orders. An order in O sub k is a subring of finite index. as a module. And the maximal order is just the ring of integers itself. It's the biggest of all the orders. So that's what I mean by maximal order. You could replace ring of integers here, and you get exactly the same function. So now you can say ints of, say, x cubed minus 2, and that prints out the ring of integers. Ints of x squared minus 5 prints out the thing. Ints of, So in the notes I give all these, near the end of page 38, I define something so you can, again, see how long it takes. So ints of, what this means, this notation that I'm writing, I'll just finish typing it and explain it. Oops. Okay. All right, so what does that do? First, it sets d equal to 10, and then what it does is for I equal to 0, from 0 to d, it makes a sequence, which is I times xi, and then I just threw in this for fun, 2 times x plus 1, just because when I didn't include that, somehow it became trivial to compute the ring of integers. So it sums up this polynomial, where I varies between 0 and d. That's what the and plus does. If you have any sequence at all, you say and then some operator that can be used to accumulate the elements of the sequence, so some binary operator, and it combines together everything in the sequence and gives you one result. It adds up the sequence. So this is like sum. But you can do, if you had something where, for example, logical and makes sense, you could say and then the word and then it would and the things together. If you had something where intersection makes sense, you could do that, et cetera. If you say and star, it would multiply the polynomials together. So it's a way of compressing everything in a list together, or sequence together. And then I call the ints function on that. Actually, that bracket seems out of place. Yeah, that bracket shouldn't be there. It seemed to have worked anyways. And this is what it does. It computes the ring of integers, and there's the output. And you can see it doesn't take too long to do it. But we can make d bigger and see how long it takes. So like d equal to 20. And that takes a little longer. So in the notes, it's 1.6 seconds, which is on a computer twice as fast as this, so 4.85 seconds, et cetera, et cetera. So now we're done. So I'm going to pick up on this on Tuesday, and I'll finish giving a few more examples. I'll talk about how to work with ideals, and then I'll talk about Perry. And we'll have a similar lecture like this, you know, in a month or so when you know a lot more about algebraic number theory. But I encourage you to just play around, try these programs, et cetera.